This is a CBC podcast.
Hi there, it's Pia, and every Wednesday, we're bringing you a bonus podcast, one handpicked story from the week's round of the Sunday magazine that we think is definitely worth hearing or hearing again. Of course, you can hear all of our stories on the full podcast that we put out on Sunday and on the CBC Listen app. All right, here's this week's highlight. If you bought anything online recently, there's a good chance you shopped at one particular website. Amazon is the world's largest online marketplace with more than 300 million annual users. Last year alone, it raked in $30 billion US in profit. But the tech giant has long faced scrutiny over how it reached this huge level of success. And it came to a head last fall when the U.S. Federal Trade Commission, the FTC, and 17 states sued Amazon, accusing it of illegally protecting a monopoly over online retail. Amazon has denied those allegations. Dana Mattioli is the Wall Street Journal's dedicated Amazon reporter, and her new book paints the big picture of how Amazon got so darn big and the price paid. Her book is called The Everything War: Amazon's Ruthless Quest to Own the World and Remake Corporate Power. Hey, Dana, good morning. Thank you for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
I don't know if this will be striking to everyone, but I think it will be to a lot of people that the Wall Street Journal has a dedicated reporter, a full-time reporter in you to cover one singular company. What does that say to you about Amazon's reach and influence that a job like that is necessary?
Not only do we have me, we have another full-time reporter on Amazon. That's how big it is. It is like covering 12 publicly traded companies in one. And it's kind of funny in 2024 to think about it, how it started, because it started as this against all odds online bookstore when most people didn't even have computers in their homes. And that was clearly the canary in the coal mine. And I'm happy to give you the full picture of their scope these days, because it's really staggering.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because, you know, Americans use Amazon, everyone almost in the world does. A lot of Canadians use it as well. It accounts for roughly 41.5% of retail e-commerce sales in our country. This is according to the research company eMarketer. And so people who say, you know, the other 58.5% are saying, like, look, I don't shop on Amazon. I got nothing to do with Amazon, but you don't need to shop on Amazon to be touched by it. So give us a sense of how pervasive Amazon is in everyone's daily lives.
Yeah. I mean, this company is unavoidable from so many perspectives. You know, Jeff Bezos wanted it to become a daily habit. He didn't just want people to shop on it once a month for paper towels or books. He wanted it ingrained in consumers' lifestyles, and he's truly achieved that. He even told one of my sources, "Your margin is my opportunity." And that's how they've approached industry. So if you look at it today, it's this giant octopus of a conglomerate with so many tentacles. And it has 40% of online retail in the US. It's the world's biggest cloud computing company, one of the biggest digital advertisers in the world, the top parcel carrier in many countries. It makes the top-selling voice-activated speaker and streaming devices. It's the biggest seller of ebooks with 82% market share. And then it's a grocery store, a podcast maker, a film studio, and even a healthcare giant. In the middle of reporting out this book, they actually bought my doctor's office.
Really?
Yeah.
Like Amazon owns doctor's offices in the United States?
Yeah. They bought One Medical, which is where I've been going for years, which means all of my labs, my tests, they now belong to Amazon.
Oh, wow. Okay. So it's trying to be a behemoth in so many fields and industries.
That's right. And they've succeeded to an extent that I don't think anyone else has. It's kind of like the Standard Oil octopus when you think about it, where it's got all these tentacles in disparate places. And what's interesting is when they expand into new places, Wall Street makes a very vocal bet. If Amazon files a patent in a new industry or hires a big executive from a different company that they're maybe not in that industry yet, you often see the stock prices of all the existing companies in the space just fall. There's a sell-off, right? Because people are betting that Amazon's going to win.
You interviewed hundreds of people for your book, former Amazon execs, competitors, small business owners, and You were charting how Amazon got to where we are in 2024. Let's go back to its humble beginnings. Jeff Bezos started Amazon out of his home garage in Washington State. This is 1994, so 30 mm-hmm. years ago. Sold only books. But this was the early days of the internet when e-commerce was barely a thing yet. So it was pretty revolutionary even at that time. But what potential did Bezos see in the future of online shopping back in 94?
He did books as this test item because they were small. There's too many titles to fit in one bookstore, so you could have unlimited selection online. And that was really just the litmus test to test out the whole idea of online commerce. What's really interesting about Amazon.com is he got the idea while he was working in New York for a hedge fund called D.E. Shaw. His boss was really bullish on the internet back when most people weren't even using it. 3% of people had even been online at that point in the U.S. And his boss said, hey, can you research selling things on the internet? And that's where Jeff really came up with the idea for Amazon.com.
Hmm. And so after its early success in those early days, Amazon expands well beyond books. It becomes this one-stop shop that we know today. It becomes that in part, Dana, because of the millions of smaller retailers that sell all their stuff on the site. So I shop at Amazon from time to time. It's often a third-party retailer, but I buy it through Amazon. So if I was a small business, what might my relationship with Amazon look like? Like, what do I owe them, both financially and perhaps otherwise, in order to be able to sell my wares there?
Yeah, when you speak to the sellers, it's truly this double-edged sword. They have to be on Amazon because there's so many shoppers there. There's 200 million Prime members worldwide. They can't just forsake that. Even though so many of them complain about the relationship, Amazon has been able to raise their fees on sellers because they know that sellers need to be there. So over the last decade, for instance, the average take that Amazon gets of each dollar of revenue from a third-party seller went from 19% to 45%.
Wow.
And that's made it really hard for these sellers to make a living. And some of them have had to raise their prices on their goods in order to offset it. And that's where the FTC comes into play. They're saying Amazon is causing higher prices for consumers.
Yeah, let's talk about that FTC lawsuit that you just mentioned. I mentioned in our introduction. So it accuses Amazon of illegally protecting a monopoly over online retail by squeezing merchants and favoring its own services. The company, Amazon itself, denies all this. But can you break down more specifically what that looks like according to this lawsuit?
Yes. So the FTC lawsuit is alleging two things. They're saying that Amazon knows that sellers need to be on Amazon because of how big it is. And with that in mind, they're able to levy all sorts of fees on the sellers. And in some ways, being a seller on Amazon.com, the platforms become pay to play. So you need to buy ads to even show up in the search results, and Amazon gets a fee. You need to have Amazon Logistics in order to be a part of Prime, Amazon gets a fee. And it's gone up to that 45% number. In turn, those sellers have just become, it's become a lot harder for them to make profits. So they've raised the prices for consumers. But the really interesting part of the FTC lawsuit is they say that Amazon has so much power in e-commerce. And because they sold for so long, they contractually made their sellers sign an agreement that Amazon would have the lowest price of their goods, even if they sold elsewhere, that if they had to offset all the fees on Amazon and raise their prices, they also had to raise their prices on other websites. Hmm. So the FTC is saying that Amazon has raised prices throughout e-commerce.
And for me as a consumer, that means I'm paying more for a product that I could get at many places because of the deal that Amazon has struck with a small business I want to buy the product from.
Exactly. And I have examples of that in the book, in practice, where that has happened. There's one seller that I spoke to. He took over his dad's family business. He wanted to digitize it to get more of an audience. He signs it up for Amazon.com. And they make $10 million a year in revenue on Amazon.com, which sounds great. But after, you know, he pays $1.5 million a year in advertising there. He pays for shipping. He pays for all these other things. And the overhead, it turns into $30,000 in profits at the end of the year.
Hmm. Let's talk about Jeff Bezos, one of the richest people on the planet. He owns a lot of things, including Amazon. You describe him as having a quote-unquote killer instinct and the atmosphere that he has built at the company. Tell me more about Jeff Bezos's killer instinct, the influence that's had on Amazon's culture, and how that sort of shaped the way it all approaches business.
Yeah, I mean, there's no denying that Bezos is brilliant and he was a visionary. But personality-wise, he could be very Machiavellian. There are anecdotes in the book that almost paint a cruel portrait of him, where he could be petty or not nice. There's one scene in the book where Toys R Us has a new CEO, and Bezos calls the CEO up on the first week of his job and says, "Hey, how does it feel to work with poor performers?" Just out of nowhere. And the guy's sort of taken aback. And he tells his early employees that were sort of missionaries that wanted to democratize reading that they didn't have that killer instinct, to your point. And I think as it relates to the book, some of the more shocking behaviors in the book are driven by this culture that he's created. It's a very aggressive company. It's cutthroat. It could be Machiavellian. And it creates this pressure cooker of an environment where employees sometimes do whatever they can to stay ahead and keep their jobs.
Hmm. So, you know, for a lot of people, consumers out there, they say, look, I like Amazon because I get my stuff delivered to my house. It comes very quickly. I get pretty good, you know, prices. There's a lot of options available. So some might look at its success and see a good business strategy. Where is the line between good strategy and bad practice?
Well, I would say, you know, people definitely use Amazon. They like their Prime. But there have been allegations from regulators around the world that this company has too much power. It really started in Europe, where they started raising the alarm bells, and the US was a bit late to policing its own digital giants. There's now been a reckoning on that. But when you look at what these countries have been looking into, they're saying that Amazon's dominance has an effect on the broader economy, on the broader industry. And even in reporting out this book, I could tell you, like, if you just look at the retail sector and the amount of jobs lost over the last decade at the hands of Amazon is pretty staggering. When I speak to venture capitalists, they are careful on not backing companies that might go head to head with Amazon because it's like a foregone conclusion that Amazon's going to win, right? So there's other effects on innovation, on job creation and the like.
What are the job losses over the last decade?
There's a few different reports on this. The American Booksellers Association found that in 2018 alone, there was a net loss of 700,000 retail jobs in the U.S. And this next stat is like actually pretty telling to me. In the U.S., between 2001 and 2017, department stores lost 18 times as many jobs than coal mining. And I could tell you, I spoke to a lot of the mall owners for this book, department store CEOs, and they do point at Amazon for a lot of this.
If you're just joining us on this Sunday, I'm Pia Chattopadhyay, and I'm speaking with Dana Mattioli, reporter with the Wall Street Journal who covers Amazon. Dana has a new book out about how the company has shaped online retail and the big questions it all raises about competition and consumerism. So, Dana, you mentioned Standard Oil. I want to talk about the comparison that you made between Amazon and Standard Oil. Of course, that is the American oil empire that was run by J.D. Rockefeller around the turn of the 20th century. The U.S. government successfully sued that company over its monopoly over the industry. It led it to being broken up. So draw the parallel here for me.
Yeah. So it's actually really interesting. The head of the FTC, Lena Khan, who has brought this lawsuit against Amazon, when she first started researching the company back when she was in law school, she drew the parallel between Bezos and Rockefeller. And she was doing this research for this anti-monopoly think tank called Open Markets, and she kept running into Amazon. And it just seemed strange to her that Amazon was considered this darling while Standard Oil had been broken up for being a monopoly. And she saw some similarities in the way they competed. Both were spying on competitors. They engaged in predatory pricing. They would bully their partners. And it was just striking to her that no one was questioning Amazon's power.
The Standard Oil case, just to understand this a bit more, was brought under antitrust law, basically another word for competition law. The case against Amazon revolves around how such laws are interpreted. So how has Amazon changed that conversation around antitrust laws in the U.S.?
So Amazon and big tech in general has sort of benefited from this change in the interpretation of antitrust laws in the 1970s and 80s. The laws were first derived in the Gilded Age, and they were enforced initially to protect competition and small businesses and the like. But then there was a period in time in the 60s and 70s where some critics thought that it was overreaching, that it wasn't protecting competition, it was inhibiting competition, that it was going too far, and the courts were siding too much with David versus Goliath. So there was this school that came about called the Chicago School of Antitrust Theory. And they started saying, you know, we're doing this all wrong. We should judge competition based on prices for consumers and efficiencies. And the courts accepted that. And for the last 40 years, that's how things have changed. And it's allowed companies like Amazon, but also Google, Facebook, where they either have free products or, you know, in Amazon's early days, they were a very low price retailer. So if you had free or low prices, you could kind of skate by, even if you were doing other things that might have been enforced in prior decades.
Yeah, there's that ongoing case by the U.S. Justice Department accusing Google of illegally abusing its power over online search to throttle competition. The FTC has filed that suit against Meta, accusing of bullying rivals to illegally squash competition. So both companies have denied the allegations. But I'm wondering, Dana, with, you know, sort of the tech environment, what does this picture say about the larger conversation happening around the regulation of big tech right now? And why haven't we seen more government oversight around Amazon until now?
It's just really fascinating. For a very long time, the U.S. was late to police its own giants. And these companies were really held up as examples of innovation and job creation. They were like very, very embraced by like the Obama administration, you know? And there were some rallying cries abroad to better police these giants that were dismissed in the U.S. And more recently, I think, you know, the 2016 election was a big turning point where people saw misinformation on digital platforms and started to question big tech. I think Lina Khan's paper about Amazon in 2017 also started making people question big tech and Amazon specifically. And now there's this new movement in the U.S. that's really gaining momentum, led by Lina Khan and John Cantor, who's the head of the DOJ here, the Department of Justice. Even some Republicans are aligned with this mission, and they're saying, you know, we need to rein these giants in. And there have been a lot of lawsuits against big tech in the recent years.
So right now, there is this public conversation, and policymakers are grappling with the question of how big is too big for a corporation. You have reported that Amazon's current president and CEO, Andy Jassy, is asking a different question. He is not asking how big is too big. He's asking, is it big enough? And he recently told his deputies that Amazon could become a $10 trillion U.S. company in the next decade. It would be the biggest in history. So what could the future of Amazon look like? Where else could we see it appear in our lives if it continues down the path its leadership wants it to?
Yeah, I think it's very telling that in the midst of all this scrutiny, they're saying, let's, you know, five times our size is if we could get to, right? And there are areas that they are definitely focused on. One of them is artificial intelligence. It's obviously a huge area for a lot of companies right now, and Amazon's really well positioned, especially with their Amazon Web Services business, to really capitalize on that. They've made investments in other generative AI companies. Healthcare is definitely an area of focus. It's one of the biggest sources of GDP. They've really just started scratching the surface there. And they are, you know, imminently going to be launching satellites in their Kuiper business to compete with Starlink. So there's a lot of different areas that they're just starting to get into that they're dedicating a lot of resources. So the $10 trillion figure, while it sounds crazy, it could be achievable.
And so for me, sitting behind my computer, flicking on my Prime and watching it, or I don't know, listening to an ebook on Audible, all those things that I do, and many Canadians do. What do you want me to think about? I mean, hopefully I'll just lose myself in a book or in a show, but what do you want me to think about in terms of Amazon when I'm using their products?
You know, there are a few companies in business history that have had as much of an impact on life, on the economy, on job creation as Amazon, but they've really done a good job remaining this black box. They are secretive by design. And I hope that when people read this book, it really lifts the veil on their business practices, how they have their thumb on the scale in a lot of ways, what that means for partners, competitors. And, you know, there's parts of the book that I think will be really revealing, like how they use their M&A apparatus, how they use their venture capital funds and meet with all of these unsuspecting entrepreneurs and founders who then cry foul and say that Amazon stole their ideas. They opened up their kimono and stole the ideas. And I think this will shed a lot of light on how Amazon works.
Din, appreciate your work on this, and thank you for pulling back the curtain on this, as you have written about and for many years now, this really important company to all of our lives. Thanks a lot, eh?
Thank you for having me.
Dana Mattioli reports on Amazon for The Wall Street Journal. Her new book is called The Everything War. By the way, we reached out to Amazon for comment. The company sent a statement reading, in part, quote, "The facts show Amazon has made shopping easier and more convenient for customers, spurred lower prices, enabled millions of successful small businesses, and significantly increased competition in retail." In response to some specific claims in Dana's reporting, the company told us the following. Amazon selling fees are 15% or less in most product categories. Advertising is an optional service. Sellers can manage logistics themselves and still be part of Prime through its seller-fulfilled Prime program. And the suggestion that Amazon steals entrepreneurs' ideas is an inaccurate characterization. And quote, "gaining insight to copy products is in no way part of this team's mandate." You can find all the stories we bring you each week on the Sunday Magazine over on our website, cbc.ca/Sunday. I'm Pia Chattopadhyay. Thank you for lending us your ear, and we'll talk to you again on Sunday.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.